Hello everyone and welcome to Journey to Success Radio, a show featuring people and companies who are making a positive contribution to the world. This show will help you learn how to apply success principles in every area of your life so that you can make the most out of your skills and talents and accomplish more of your goals. To find out more about the show, please visit www.journeytosuccessradio.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to Journey to Success Radio. My name is Tom Tutal Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor, helping people to think, speak, and act positively through the many and varied challenges of life. You can find out more about me in this interview at my website, which is Tom, the number 2, and Tall, T-A-L-L.com. My guest today is Julianne Burleson. She's a registered reflexologist and owner of Holistic Soul Reflexology. She began her career in the healing arts after graduating from the Tennessee School of Beauty, working at Balaza Day Spa and the world-renowned Chateau Elan in Braselton, Georgia, as a therapist for many years. She's also an inspirational speaker for women's groups, weekend retreats, and conferences across the country. When she was in her 20s, Julianne was tricked into bringing back cocaine-filled artwork from Ecuador and wound up with a 10-year prison sentence there. Camp Inca was the main prison where she was incarcerated, and in 1997, while in that prison, she was interviewed by the late Mike Wallace of the show 60 Minutes for the episode Innocence Abroad, and I understand that that camp was known as the worst camp on the planet for women. Welcome to the show today, Julianne.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm amazing. You know, I always answer amazing, and sometimes it's to remind myself, and other times it's true. Today it's to a good reminder to myself that it's true. Remember, 40% of the world live on less than $2 a day. Now, this is amazing, spending 5 years in an Ecuadorian prison. What do you call it? You said it was the worst prison in the world for women.
Yeah, one of the prisons that I was in, actually, while I was in Ecuador, Guayaquil, it was rated the worst prison in the world at the time. Caracas, Venezuela was rated the worst for men at that time. So it was a pretty scary place. But my journey actually began in Quito.
Oh, I've heard of Quito. Is that a capital city?
Yes. It's a beautiful city, like 12,000 miles up in this, or 12,000 feet up in the Andes Mountain, and it's quite beautiful. There's a lot of historic churches there and a lot of scenic countrysides.
Well, that's where I heard from it. My sister has been on a medical mission trip, I believe, through World Vision to that city. And once you start describing high up in the mountains, it's like, okay, that's where I've heard it before. I understand it's a beautiful area, but not a very wealthy area.
Yeah, that's true.
So people are wondering, I'm wondering, what happened that led up to your arrest? How did you get tricked into this horrible adventure that ended up costing you so many years in that Ecuadorian prison?
Well, let me just tell you, I'm originally from Southern California, and back in 1995, some friends of mine invited me to go to Miami for 4th of July week, and so I decided to go, and while I was in Miami, my friend that I had traveled there with asked me if I wanted to continue on to Ecuador with her and her boyfriend to keep her company while he was doing some business. And at first I was kind of like, well, you know, I don't really have money to go. And, you know, I had all the excuses why I couldn't go. And they were like, come on, you're always talking about like traveling the world and stuff. Just come with us. We'll pay for it. It's no big deal. So I thought, okay, well, why not? Well, the next day, so they went ahead and bought the tickets and everything, and the next day when we were getting ready to leave for the airport, my friend couldn't find her passport. And so we kind of tore the room up looking for the passport all over the room and everything, and her and her boyfriend got in a big fight, and so he stormed out of the room. And a few minutes later, he came back, and he said, you know what? He said, he said, it's no problem. He goes, you'll go ahead of us to Ecuador and we'll just catch the next flight tomorrow and meet you there. And I said, well, wait a minute. I don't want to go by myself. I mean, I'm going to keep you company. So anyways, they talked me into going, and I went ahead and I flew into Ecuador. And when I got there, it was a little bit strange because there was like a big chain link fence at the airport, and it almost looked like there were refugees like hanging on the fence. It was very third world. I was like, are they trying to get out? Are they trying to, you know, are they trying to keep them in? It was just very surreal because I had never been to a third world country before. So I spent the day there in Ecuador. I went to my hotel and everything. And the next day, this couple, they called me and they said, oh, well, I said, oh, so are you on your way? And they said, well, we actually have some really bad news. They're like, you know, during that time, the Unabomber was giving out a lot of threats to all the federal buildings in the U.S. and I think all over the world, actually. And so they weren't issuing emergency passports at that time. So she told me, she said, I'm not going to be able to come. And I said, oh, okay, well, then I'll just, you know, change my flight and I'll be on the next flight back home tomorrow. And she was like, well, actually, my boyfriend wanted to ask you if maybe you can change your plans a little bit and stay there for a few days and do us a big favor. And I said, well, what kind of favor? And said, well, you know, he was going there on business and he was going to pick up some artwork to bring it back to a restaurant that they were going to be opening up in New York. And they were going to decorate the restaurant, the Ecuadorian style restaurant, with this artwork. That's why they were going there. And I was like, oh, well, you never say anything about any artwork. And so, well, that's what we were going there for. So if you would do us a great favor and bring it back for us, it would be great. It would save us a lot of money. And, you know, so I started to question it. I was like, well, can't you just send it UPS or Federal Express or something? And they were like, well, it'll be super expensive if we do it that way. So if you could just, you know, bring it on the plane with you, it will only cost like $200 and, you know, we'll pay you back when you get there or whatever. I was like, well, I don't know. You know, it sounds kind of weird. And they're like, Julianne, we're your friends. We would never put you in a bad situation. What are you afraid of? So those words kind of came back to haunt me. Like, they still haunt me till this day. And so long story short, I went to the airport. And when I got there, you know, the artwork got checked in and everything into customs. And I went to exchange my currency back to dollars because they had a different currency back then. And right when I was on my way to exchange it, I hear my name over the loudspeaker. And they're like, Julianne, you know, at the time my name was Estrada. Estrada, would you please come to customs? And so I made my way to customs. And when I got there, I was in customs, was kind of in this old-fashioned airplane hangar. It looked like something out of, like, World War II, basically. And as I walked into the middle of this airplane hangar, I saw three boxes, and those boxes actually had the artwork in them, and my suitcase. And so I walk over, and I'm like, what's going on? So they needed me to open up the boxes, and they wanted to, you know, check them out. I guess they do it for everybody that's going through customs with large shipments. So I said, okay. So they opened them and everything, and they took the pictures out. They were artwork that looked like pictures. They were made out of ceramic, and they were kind of an oval shape. And they had a picture of, like, a painted picture of a countryside on top of them, painted on top of it with little, like, animals and people kind of painted on there. So they said, well, can we put them through the scanners? And I said, sure. So they put them through the scanners three times, and they didn't seem to find anything. Next thing they did was they brought over the dogs and the big German Shepherd dogs to sniff them, and the dogs all sniffed them, and they didn't really seem like they wanted anything to do with the pictures, so they kind of walked away. And so then the police officers started kind of shaking the artwork and putting it up to the light and, you know, just doing random tests, I guess, on it. And I looked at my watch and I said, my plane's getting ready to leave. should we be wrapping this up? And they're like, oh, yeah, this is fine. We do this for everyone. I'm like, okay, I'm getting a little worried because my plane's going to leave. And they're like, no, everything's fine. Everything seems to be okay. So they start wrapping the artwork back up and putting it away and everything, boxing it up. And out of nowhere comes this guy, and he looked very, very official. He had kind of like one of those official hats on, you know, like a – he looked like he was in the military. He had a hat on and like stripes on his shirts and stuff. And the next thing I know, he takes one of the pieces of art and he takes it over to an office. And then I said, who's that? And they just kind of nodded like they didn't know. And then the next thing I knew, the guy came running back. He had actually drilled a tiny little hole with like a sharp metal object into one of the pieces of art, and cocaine was streaming out. And he was yelling, cocaine, cocaine. And right then, I actually passed out. They started ripping open all the other pieces of art, and there was like cocaine all over the floor. So I passed out cold when I saw it. And
wow.
Yeah, that's how my story began.
Wow. Passing out. You knew from what he said and what you saw. You knew you were basically screwed, that this was going to be a horrible, horrible incident. And so my wife works for a criminal defense lawyer here in Canada, and I know the system pretty well here, but she keeps telling me how blessed we are to have such a good system here in Canada. How long did it take for you in Ecuador to be arrested and for your case to actually get to trial? Because that can be a long wait. When you're innocent, you want to get your case to court as soon as possible, right?
Yeah, it actually took me 2 years to get to court. During that two-year period, I had been transferred around quite a bit to different prisons. I started out at Interpol. That when I got arrested, they took me to Interpol. And then I was there about 3 days, and then they didn't charge me there. My embassy came out and they said, you have to charge her or let her go. And they didn't know what to do with me. So they sent me to another facility called CDP. And I spent about 15 to 18 days there. And I got super sick while I was there. I got pneumonia, and I was sleeping on floors with 20 women in a big rat infested, like, cage, basically. Whoa. And then they never did charge me with anything while I was there either, and Human Rights came out and they said, you have to either charge her or let her go. So they decided, well, they can't charge me, and they don't, you know, so they went ahead and transferred me to another jail called El Inca Carcel de Mujeres, which is what I nicknamed Camp Inca. And so I spent about a year there, and then one night in the middle of the night, they actually came to my cell and transferred me because they believed I was going to try and escape. And I wasn't planning an escape at that time, and not yet anyways. And so they moved me in the middle of the night, and they took me to a jail called Latacunga, which is close to Cotopaxi, the Cotopaxi volcano, which is exploding right now. It's not exploding a lot, but they've had a lot of little explosions from it, and they're kind of worried about it now, right now, actually. But so, yeah, I got transferred like 4 times before I even went to court, and then eventually I got sent back to Camp Inca, and then I started going to court. It took a little bit longer, actually, for me to get sentenced, because just because you go to court doesn't mean you get sentenced. Right. I actually went to court about 5 times before I actually got a sentence, and then finally about 3 years, then I got my sentence came down to 10 years, And everybody thought I was going to be going free up until that point. I mean, even like the DEA and like the embassy and police and like even the guards, they were like, she's going to go free. Don't worry about it. We all know she's innocent. And, you know, and so not only was I getting so frustrated and just, you know, it was awful being there. I mean, every day was a struggle. But also my family was going through a lot here in the States because they were trying to do everything they could to get me out. And they were getting contacted by like CIA, ex-CIA agents and people claiming that they could extract me, you know, for like $100,000 or something crazy. And my parents were like, well, we don't have that kind of money, you know. But I mean, they were willing to do whatever it took to get me out of there, but they just couldn't. So yeah, it took me 2 years to get to court, and I did wind up getting a 10-year sentence, and that's when I decided I wanted to try to escape.
Wow, this is like the ultimate nightmare. Like you see sometimes on TV, at least in Canada, U.S., people who have been convicted who are innocent and who spend time in jail who are innocent, but rarely in a third world country rated the worst prison in the world for women. How on earth is it possible to maintain any sanity or hope or not just curl up and die in a ball? Because this is like a situation that is just unbelievable. And you, although, as you said, like everybody thought you were going to go free, were you ever able to determine, like, what the heck happened? I was just convicted when everybody around me in this system said I was going to be going free, that they knew I was innocent. Like, so I guess up until then you have hope, but once you're sentenced, like, how do you not go just plain insane?
Well, I did, basically. You know, it was really hard to keep my sanity while I was there. I didn't speak the language. They spoke Spanish there. And, you know, of course, in the prison, you have people from all over the world, so you have different languages, but the main language was Spanish. And it took me a long time to learn it. I didn't start learning it until I was there about 3 years. And I, you know, people would say, well, maybe we need to bring you some books, like missionaries and stuff. They would say, well, we can bring you books, you know, and you can start to learn Spanish. And I'm like, I don't want to learn Spanish because I don't want to stay here. You know, it's like I don't want to make myself at home. I don't want to have a kid. I don't want to get married to anyone. It's like I want to go home. And so it was really frustrating because most of the other prisoners that were there, you know, once they were sentenced, they kind of got really comfortable. You know, they had a kid. They, you know, they just made themselves at home, and they decided, you know, well, I'm going to be here for X amount of time. I'm going to just make the most out of it. But I just wouldn't do that. So I cried probably every day that I was there, but I always try to be really productive. Like, how am I going to get out of here? You know, so I started actually reading law books in Spanish, and not even knowing, that's how I pretty much taught myself how to speak Spanish, was, you know, reading law books and trying to communicate with people in Spanish, but I never did take a course. And you know, it really was a day-to-day struggle. After I was there 3 years, you know, I did try to escape, and they actually caught me, but we were going to make a hole in one of the walls, and they caught it right as it, when we were going to break out of it. And they weren't sure who had dug that hole, and so they figured out that I was one of the people involved with it, and so they transferred me. That's when they transferred me to Guayaquil. And when I was in Guayaquil, that was actually, like we said, it's the worst prison in the world. They had snakes there. They had scorpions. They have crazy elephant grass that's like 3 feet high, you know, throughout the prison. And it's just awful and dirty, and there's lots of, you know, murders there, and it's just terrible, horrible. When you get there, all it does is smell of death. I mean, basically. So When I was there, though, my dad came to visit me, and he asked me, he said, I have a couple of things to talk to you about. One is we want you to go on 60 Minutes. They're going to be out here interviewing another guy that's on the men's side of the prison, and they need another person to interview, so, and you're the only one here that's innocent, so you're the obvious choice. And I said, well, okay, yeah, I can do that. And then another thing he wanted to talk to me about was, he said, Julian, have you been reading your Bible? And I was like, no, Dad, are you okay? And so I'm like, because my dad wasn't a Christian up until that point. So I was really surprised. And so that helped because, you know, I started reading my Bible a little bit, and it really brought a little bit a peace to my life. Even though I was in the worst possible prison in the world, I was still gaining a little bit of peace. And around that time also, I want to tell you this one story, because this was a big turning point in my life that I started to forgive. There was a drug lord that was a Colombian drug lord that was on the men's side of the prison. He had heard about my story, you know, since I had been on the 60 Minutes clip. And so he wanted to meet me. And so one day he got some permissions and stuff for me to go over to the men's side and talk with him. And he asked me, you know, about my story. And I told him my whole story. And when I was done telling him, he said, did you ever wonder what would have happened to you if you wouldn't have gotten arrested? And I said, well, I said, I would have gone on to Miami, you know, and then to California, and the artwork would have went on to New York, and I would have never known the difference that there were drugs in it. And he said, no, that's not what would have happened. He said, first of all, in Miami, a couple guys would have probably met you at the airport, and they would have taken you and the artwork to an undisclosed location, and they would have taken it out, they would have weighed it, they would have measured it, they would have tested it to make sure it was the shipment that they had ordered, and then they probably would have held a gun to your head, and they might have given you one of two choices. Either you do this for them again and become like their human slave, basically, or they would have just killed me. And in that moment, I found like peace. I always say I found peace from a drug lord in that moment, because yeah. It was so amazing. I was like, oh my gosh, it's like things could be worse. I mean, so I almost feel like after that point, it was a turning point where I felt like, you know, that God had protected me rather than punished me.
Wow.
And it really helped me to let go of feelings, bad feelings I had to the friends that had did this to me. And it helped me, you know, and I've always heard that, you know, forgiveness is more about forgiveness for yourself more than somebody else, you know, so you can move on. And that is so true. But that was a valuable lesson that I have learned. And it was amazing that it came from a drug lord.
Wow. Amazing. What a horrific life story, where actually being imprisoned in a third world jail was better than going back and delivering. Who would have ever? I had never thought of that.
Then after that, the prison started going a little bit crazy. So I decided I was going to try and get back to Camp Inca because I needed to finish out my course of my, you know, my sentence at that prison. So that way, when it was time for me to go free, I would be able to go free easier, because you need to be in your province, right, when, you know, it's time to go free. So I fought really hard to get back there, but I did. I got back to Camp Inca, and then, you know, my remainder of my time there. It's amazing, because after that trip to Guayaquil, my life got a little bit easier, and I know it had to be because the Lord was in my life, you know,
Amen.
That I had accepted him.
Wow. So imagine a story as horrible as yours where actually going to prison actually saved your life. I had never even thought of it, but for sure, once you delivered those paintings, as that drug lord had told you in prison, they would have either made you to be a human mule slave to them, or they would have killed you. And until you met him, that thought never came to my mind, and until you mentioned the story, and probably never came to your mind either, that actually being in prison saved your life, because it sounds pretty sure like that's what those people receiving the artwork on the other end would have done to you.
Yes.
And then imagine a father who's not even a Christian suggesting you read the Bible, and I'm a Christian. I've read that thing back and forth at least 15 times. And for instance, the Apostle Paul, the most inspirational writing of all time, often comes while he's chained to soldiers on either side of him, and you would never gather from reading what he's writing that he's in prison that probably the same quality of the one in Ecuador with big iron chains on his feet while he's writing this most inspirational letters that will be transferred and read and inspire billions of people around the world. Incredible to think about how the Bible can bring hope to someone even in dire, dire, horrible circumstances like you were.
Yes, I totally agree.
Wow. If that's not an advertisement for reading the Bible, come on. Now the picture on your book is interesting, colorful. Where did that picture come from?
Well, actually, when I had gone back to Camp Inca, one morning I was sleeping. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I hear this knock on my door, and I was like, "What? I'm sleeping," you know. And they're like, "Open the door." And so I opened the door, and they said, "Look out your window." And I said, "Why?" And when I looked out my window, this big volcano had exploded. Outside my window. It was like 5 miles from the prison, and I just happened to have a throwaway camera in my room because a missionary had given it to me because she wanted me to take some candid shots of the prison because they were going to do a documentary on it. And so I grabbed the camera and I just started clicking away, you know. And I was like, wow. I mean, in one moment, I just took a step back and realized how small we are as people in the bigger scheme of things, you know. And it was just so overwhelming and just right there outside my window. So when I got home, I actually still had those pictures. And I always thought if I ever did write a book that that volcano was going on my cover.
Oh, wow. Wow. Now, the history of behind the picture, it's even more meaningful. Talk of what was it like being on 60 Minutes? Mike Wallace just asked you like half a dozen questions, and did you get treated better by people in prison after, or did it generate any kind of positive results of being on 60 Minutes?
It was funny because, like, the people there, the Ecuadorian people, they didn't really know what was going on so
Right, they
much.
don't watch 60 Minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a Spanish version or something kind of like it, but they didn't really know what it was. And they actually came and spent like 3 days with me, and his film crew spent 3 days on the women's side with me, and he did. He came like one or two of those days, and then the actual interview that was on 60 Minutes, that was aired on 60 Minutes, was filmed on the men's side because it's a lot cleaner and more organized, I guess you could say. The women's side was not organized one bit, and it was just awful, terrible, dirty, and everything. And I don't know, it's just, I guess 60 Minutes didn't really feel like the American public was ready to see that and know really what was going on there, because a lot of the interview actually got, clipped out of it. So on the cutting room floor, unfortunately. But it was neat spending some time with Mike Wallace. He is a very nice man, and I talked to him about, things that just all the different interviews he had done, in his life, and it was amazing to spend a little bit of time with somebody normal for a change.
Yeah.
I was always very excited when I got any kind of visits, because people would come and visit me from like the South American Explorers Club and other church groups and things like that. And so I was always super happy when, you know, they came to see me, because we would have normal conversations. And of course they wanted to know my story, but I could find out what was going on in the world.
That's helpful. Now, your book reached number one status on Amazon in several categories. What is it you want to do with this book and with your story? Who is it that you want to reach, and what message do you want to give people? Because, my goodness, I cannot even imagine. I'm one of the most positive people in the world and pretty resilient, but I cannot imagine going through what you went through. And so what is it you want to do with this book and the story, and who is it that you want to reach with your message?
Yes, I would love to reach out to women between the ages of 18 and 30, specifically like sorority girls, because I think sorority girls were a lot like how I was. You know, they're in school all year or whatever, and then they, you know, I had a job at the time, I wasn't in school, but it was like in the summer, you know, they like to travel and have fun, and they just think that they're so untouchable, like nothing will ever happen to them. And I was that girl where I trusted people. I never had a reason to not trust people. I would share taxis with people in L.A. And, you know, I just never met a stranger. And I always thought, oh, if I did get in trouble, my dad would probably bail me out. And that's how young girls think these days. And so if I could make a difference in their lives, so that way hopefully they wouldn't make the same, just educating them. And so that way they wouldn't make the same mistakes I did. But also, I would like to also let them know that if they did make mistakes like that, that it's not the end of the world, you know. There are blessings that will come out of them eventually, not right away, because we do have to, obviously, you know, when we make those mistakes, obviously we have to deal with the consequences, unfortunately. But it does make us a stronger and better person. So I would like to reach out to that age group, but also to any age group and any gender. I mean, I've spoken at women's retreats and conferences so far, and so far I'm getting a lot of really good, great feedback, and people are saying, oh my gosh, I want my daughter to hear your story. Oh, I want my son to hear your story. You know, I want my grandchild to hear it. And so I'm getting a lot of really good feedback. And so I really just want to make a difference. I want to get the word out there that, you know, no matter what you've gone through, you can still make a difference in other people's lives. And Camp Inca is actually, you know, it was a literal prison that I was in, but I'm also using it as a metaphor. Like, what is your Camp Inca? What have you been through? Do you keep going back to it, or do you move forward and do something with it?
Now you're talking, because this is in the realm of your husband Gary's field. Napoleon Hill taught us that thoughts are things. And the average person experiences 60,000 thoughts a day. And so I'm trying to help people to maintain a positive balance of those thoughts during difficult times, challenging times, adversity. There's no one better that could help people, teach people, and encourage people to think more positive thoughts than yourself. Have a third world jail, horrible conditions, innocent, and you're stuck with your 60,000 thoughts a day. There's a lot of hope you can give men, women, anybody that are suffering with thoughts that are pounding through their 60,000 thoughts a day about their challenges. Talk a little bit about that, because maintaining control of those 60,000 thoughts, especially while you're in a prison, and then even afterwards, not being filled with hatred and other negative emotions, and actually using that story for the good of God and others. Talk about that a bit, because that's pretty an incredible part of your story as well.
Yes, I agree. It's so hard not to go down the rabbit hole while you're there. I wish somebody would have brought me Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill while I was there. That would have been like a phenomenal book for me to read while I was there. And but my family just really kept me positive, and I had missionaries that were visiting me, and I had to keep myself busy. Even though I wasn't making myself at home there, I did come up with my own projects. I started a bakery while I was there, and I actually hired on women to help me with it, so it would help them support their family and, not get involved with drugs and men and all this other stuff, or women, whatever what they were into, to pass the time. So I always tried to think of things that were more of a positive light. And we also started a Bible study there, which is actually still going strong 15 years later. I recently met a girl that was incarcerated there 2 years after I left, and she's been free now about I think about 8 years, and she came to visit me here in Knoxville, Tennessee, and a couple of weeks ago, and she was like, "Oh my gosh, Julianne, I'm finally meeting you. You're like the legend." I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "No, you don't even understand." She's like, "Everybody, when they get arrested and they're a foreigner, they go into the jail. It's like the first stories they start hearing is about Julianne, the American, and all the things I did while I was there to like make life better." And it's kind of funny because I didn't realize I did that while I was there. It wasn't until after I left that I was like, "Wow, I did all those things," and I started writing the book. And but I was that kind of person anyways before I went in there, so I guess, I tried to, make things happen, I guess it was. So it just shows you that no matter what kind of situation you are in, you don't have to be in jail to do something great. No matter what situation you're in, you can start a Bible study, you can start a bakery, you can start whatever, your talent is. Find out what your talent is and become it, That's the best kind of job to have is a job that you love, that you love to do. Right now, I'm a reflexologist by trade, and I actually taught myself reflexology when I was in prison. So it's kind of funny how that came out of that. And when I got back to the States, I became certified in Georgia, and then now I'm registered through the state here in Tennessee. And I have my own practice. It's at a wellness center called Alma Diem. It's a wellness and healing arts center. But next year, we have some really exciting things that are going to be happening. We're going to start doing workshops, and we have a team about, right now we have a team with about 8 people, but it's growing to about 12 to 15. And we're going to be doing workshops and events and different things. And it's all going to be, around, it's all going to be based around wellness and healing arts inside and out, and really maximizing the present, and concentrating on that and helping other people and making a difference in the world.
Amen. That's what we're here for. That's what we're here for. We each have a purpose that we were designed and created for. And so, if you can help people even just do that, that's probably the most important thing you could ever teach anybody. So let's remind people, or I haven't even told them yet, so reminding's the wrong word, but your website is Camp Inca, INCA.com. So Camp, if I need to spell that for people who need something more than a book, then Inca, INCA.com, CampInca.com. Thank you so much, Julianne, for being on the show. This is an incredible story. It's no wonder that your book reached best-selling status in a number of categories. I got to read it myself
And
because,
also in Canada, we were number 3, and in Australia, we were number 8.
Wow. Well, for sure, I got to read it, for sure. No matter what anybody's challenge in North America is, I think if they read that book, they're going to feel better after reading that book. Even
Aww.
if nothing about their current challenge changes, your book will at least make them think, well, at least I'm not Julianne.
Yes, things could be worse.
Things could be worse. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. This is an amazing story. CampInca.com is the website. Surviving Camp Inca is the book, which is available on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, wherever books are sold. Find the book, read the book. It will help you. I'm looking forward to reading it myself. So just thank you so much for being on the show today, Juliana. I really, really appreciate your time, and what an amazing story.
You're welcome. It was great meeting you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Journey to Success Radio. If you or anyone you know would like to be interviewed for the show, email Tom at tom2tall.com for details.